Hello, my name is Jen Charteris. I'm the Exec Director of Crosslands, based in the UK, working around Europe and beyond. This afternoon, I'm here with Dave Patti. Dave Patti is the founder and the president of Josiah Venture, and we're going to hear a little bit more about that in a moment. I'm so delighted to be able to have this. Dave and I have really enjoyed chatting a little bit about leadership paradigms, and I'm really looking forward to delving into that. Dave, welcome this afternoon. Tell us a little bit more about Josiah Venture and its origins back in the early 90s, I think.
That's right. Well, we're a leadership training organization that's focused on youth. So we try to catch leaders in their first ministry, which tends to be their youth ministry, and teach them disciple making in the context of a local church. So we want to teach them to reach the lost and make disciples and train leaders in the context of a local church. So we are working in 16 countries of Central and Eastern Europe, assisting about 700 churches that we're engaged with. And today we have 350 on our full-time staff in those 16 countries.
And how many leaders are you training a year?
Typically, it'll be between 4,000 and 5,000 leaders a year that will go through some form of our leadership training program.
That's an extraordinary reach and an impact over the years. But this all began with you traveling to Eastern Europe in the early 90s, when things were really changing fast, and you arrived as an American.
I was serving in Germany at that time, doing youth ministry on American military bases, which is kind of an interesting. There were lots of American on military bases during that time. It was the Cold War, and then everything changed. The walls came down, and so we were right next to these countries and began doing missions trips with American teenagers into Poland or Hungary or Romania, countries like that. And we would do evangelism among young people and find them extremely responsive to the gospel, and then say, we've got to get you plugged into a youth group. And we couldn't find very many of them. There were a few, but not very many. And as we spoke with church leaders, they said, under communism, the communists didn't want people working with young people, and they didn't want us training leaders. And so those two areas of reaching young people with the gospel and training young leaders were not well developed at that time. So we felt God's call to step into that, and that's when Josiah Venture started in 1993. So our name comes from King Josiah, who was a young king and began seeking God. And in the period between 16 and 26, he totally changed his country. So we're saying, how could we find those young Josiahs in this area of the world? And even after a time of maybe people not seeking God, those leaders could lead the way. So when we started, it was just two couples in 1993. My wife and I moved into a town not far from here where we are in Poland, just right across the border in the Czech Republic. And then another couple moved into Poland, and we began just being involved in a couple local churches and saying, how can we do youth ministry in this context? It was a very different world in 1993. It was not many years after the fall of communism, but also very exciting.
Well, we could have a wonderful conversation about developing leaders in general, but we specifically wanted to talk about developing teams and how you've kind of established the organization working with and through teams of people there. But you talk, when we've spoken, you've talked about different paradigms of leadership and how the paradigm you start with then frames and impacts everything. So tell us a little bit more about the paradigms that affect leadership.
Absolutely, a paradigm is your point of view, how you frame things. And it does affect all the little decisions you make. It was very challenging in our first years. We were working cross-culturally. We were working in a context with Czech as one of the most atheist countries on earth. And it felt like many of the things I'd learned, I didn't know if they would apply in this situation. So part of that just drove me back to Jesus, because obviously that's our best example. And if we can do things more like Jesus did, then it should work in any context. And so I had to build a youth ministry team in our local church and then start building our team. And I was asking the question, how did Jesus build his team? So I was studying the life of Christ for principles along those lines. But there's something else I noticed that really struck me, because often he would say the kingdom of heaven is like, or the kingdom of God is like. It's like what I'm trying to build is going to be like this. And as I looked at all those pictures that he talked about, I found something interesting. He was a carpenter or builder, worked with stone as well. But you don't find many building examples in his teaching. He doesn't say the kingdom of heaven is like building a table. The kingdom of heaven is like sawing some wood. But on the other hand, he uses illustrations like the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed or like the sheep and the goats or like a sower who went out to sow. Where he wasn't a farmer, why was he choosing to use these paradigms? And so I began to ask the question, is there a reason? Is there an organic paradigm of leadership that's very important? Now he does, there are some exceptions that he says that the kingdom of heaven, you know, the house on the rock or different ones like that. But actually the kingdom of heaven is like a man who built a house on a rock. Or you have the pearl of great price. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who found a pearl in a field. So what it's always like is it's like the living thing. And I began to realize that I think there are actually three main big paradigms of leadership. There's forest leadership, which we often find maybe in churches where it's about living things, but we can't really impact them very much. And so we kind of go out and hope we find something, hope we find some people for our team, hope something's growing now. It's more like hunter-gatherer kind of leadership, where we have such a trust for living things that we think there's nothing we can do about that. We just leave it in God's hands and just watch what he does, which is wonderful. The forest is a beautiful place, but it can be much less productive than something that needs to be managed. Or else we go, oh, this needs to be managed, and we flip into a factory mentality. So going from a forest mentality to a factory mentality, where it begins to be kind of mechanistic thinking. What lever can I pull? What can I saw? What buttons can I push? What's the formula that will produce this particular thing? And we lose the living dimension. Whereas a farmer is also working to provide an environment, but there are key things that are out of his control. It's the growth of living things that's what's most important. He tries to do the things around that growth that cause it to grow, and so there's a different kind of approach. So they go, I'm not getting ahead to the final metaphor. So we got the factory metaphor, which we often fall into, but then I think Jesus was giving us the farm metaphor, husbandry or farming, which you are following. There's an active engagement with a view to the laws of life, which are different than the laws of dead things.
It's a kind of intentionality about things without being in control of everything.
Exactly. So it seems like we swing from God's in control and I'm not going to be intentional to where I'm going to be intentional but take everything in my hands. What's this intentionality coupled with a respect for the things that are outside of our control, which I think really is how we should be leading.
It takes us right back to the mandate of Genesis 2, doesn't it? You know, yeah. To fulfill the earth and subdue it. We are, you know, right from the start, there's this intentionality about working with the creation
that
God has given it. One of the things I noticed is that actually the absence of cultivation or the sort of dereliction of farming outputs is one of the signs of judgment as you go through the Old Testament. So it's something that needs to be maintained. And you've spoken about that.
Yeah, it's kind of this cooperation with the work of God where I recognize that he really is working, but I'm also working as well to cultivate the things that he's doing. And I think that particularly in this day and age, most people are, a generation ago, people would have had a small farm or raised a garden and would be thinking about those principles. Today, they play video games and they spend a lot of time on their computers and we engineer things and write programs, which is wonderful. But all of that it's actually all factory work. It's not organic work. That phone is not alive, even though it might pretend to be, and that computer program isn't either. And there are some laws of life. For instance, I can work in a factory and stop and come back 5 months later and just pick up where I was before. Or I can take a computer program and back it up. Or there are all different things I can do in a mechanistic kind of word that I can't do. I can actually wound in a farm system. If I leave it, it deteriorates, that things die. There has to be a regularity. I can't do all my feeding one day and then not feed for a month. There's this regularity of care. I'm always looking for disease because there's a vulnerability of living things to be being killed. So there's these laws of life that I think actually affect this discussion that we're having about building a team.
Yeah. So let's start to press the paradigm into the concept of a staff team. So where does that start to take you in your approach to leading, building a team? Let's start with the building of a team. So bringing people into a team, for instance.
Well, I had a conversation with a friend of mine in Poland not long ago, and he said, I keep running into people on your team. They're just incredible. They're so high quality and motivated, and there's this consistent nature to them. He says, how do you find people like that? And my answer was, we don't find people like that. You have to grow people like that. So often in building a team, we think about what do I need, and I try to find a person that fulfills it and then bring them in. And that's that hunter-gatherer approach.
And the what you need is often to do with skill rather than character.
But even the skill can be grown, you know. So how do we grow people? And sometimes how can I find someone, pick them up off a shelf? But a good team builder actually builds a team for a while. He builds a team before those people are on this team. It's about investment in people. And what you find is if you consistently invest in people and care about their growth, if the time comes where you have an opening on your team and you go to that person, they're much more likely to say yes because of the investment that you made in their life. So you have to actually start building a team before you build a team. You build into people, and then from the people you build, you actually build a team. And that's that longer approach. It's like you plant a tree and maybe it's a couple of years before you have a harvest. So if you aren't doing that work, then when the time comes to need people around you, they aren't there. I was visiting the chairman of our board once, and he keeps goats. And I walked out into his area where the goats were, and they all ran away from me. And then he walked out, and they all ran to him and mauled him and jumped on him because they know that he feeds them, he cares for them, and so they run towards him. And sometimes in that hunter-gatherer approach, how do I find some team members? I have a lot of work to do. We find people running from us. But if we invest in people very purposely and care for them, they run towards us. And then when it's time to need someone, they're going, I'll volunteer, I'll be there because I know you're taking care of me.
The paradigm you're describing there just completely flips what the deal usually is when we're recruiting people to teams. It's, you know, so, and certainly in the corporate world, it's who can fulfill our needs.
Right.
And what you're describing there is how do we grow people?
Grow people, right. And we have some of my closest coworkers, I've known them since they were teenagers. So some of them, well, I've been serving the Lord with them for 20, 25 years. And there's a loyalty that develops, and we love each other. We have deep relationships. So this is not just about work that needs to be done and a job description that needs to be fulfilled. It's I want to go through life with these people. I love them. They know that. They'll know that, or they'll know that if it's not true. I care about them. I care about their good more than I care about the good of my work. And they know that too. And so sometimes I care about them so much that I shepherd them out of our team because I think it's going to be best if they go somewhere else. But if people know that, it develops loyalty, and it's like that. It's like those people actually want to be on your team, want to serve with you, because it's such an enriching experience for them.
You talked about sometimes the healthy and kind, wise thing is to shepherd somebody out. Sometimes that's just simply because there's a better fit for them elsewhere. Sometimes I'm guessing there are situations where it's just not going so well.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about how you deal with that within the paradigm you're describing.
Yeah, well, one of the things I often think about is in Hebrews where it says, make level paths for your feet so that the lame are not disabled, but rather healed. And sometimes people get lame in service, and sometimes it's our path. They don't fit well with our path anymore. Sometimes it's things that are going on with them. But you can move people on in ways that actually damage them for the rest of their lives, where they're wounded, and they're actually lame or disabled. Or you can do it in ways that are healing, and you have to care about the person more than you care about just that role that you're filling. And sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but that process would be, hey, this is not working, is it? It's not going to be good for you or for us for this to continue. We want But we believe that you're the work God's creating in God's image to do works that he's prepared in advance for you to do. So let's together figure out what are those good works he wants for you right now. And so you kind of have to get above your organization and get above your team to the purposes of God and really view that person through a shepherd's role. And if you do, that can be a very enriching experience for both of you. If you don't, you can cause lasting pain.
I've recently been rereading Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Life Together, and the sort of fundamental premise of the other being there because that is God's purposes, and some of the difficult yards that we walk as being part of God's plans and purposes and ways of helping us to flourish is very challenging. And you're describing a very similar kind of philosophy.
And one of the things that happens, I mentioned that we have 350 on our team right now, so it does mean that I can't touch every one of them. But part of what you develop is you develop leadership culture, where that you hope that becomes the way everyone relates to. So as you relate to the people that are close to you and in those kinds of those kinds of shepherding ways. So what's interesting, I'll back up just for a little bit. Sometimes people think either you care about people or you care about the work. But actually those two are intertwined, because part of how you develop people is you do work together. Does God love us not for what we do? Yeah. Well, then why does he give us work to do? Well, because he loves us, because that's part of how he grows us. When I was growing up, my dad had a huge garden, and we used to kind of farm together in the city. So this is where I learned some of these organic principles. But once, when we were selling vegetables from our back porch, someone said to my dad, he says, "Is it profitable to raise vegetables?" And he says, "Well, not really, but I'm not raising vegetables, I'm raising kids." And so we can look at we're doing a lot of ministry, but actually really in the process, we're raising kids. We're raising God's kids in the process of doing work. So we want to get a lot of good things done, but we want to grow people in the process. And so if you have that mix of, we're going to do some amazing, excellent things, they're going to be fun, and we're going to grow in the process, and we're going to take care of our people and take care of our work. So we're not going to take care of just our work or just our people. Well, we think they're tied together. And you create this culture of kind of family on mission, which is something we talk about a lot, where we're relationally connected and we're doing something important together. And that is, it's so much fun to be part of a team where you're relationally connected and you're doing something important together. Wow, I want to be in the middle of that. And then if that becomes the culture of your bigger team, you keep people, you grow people, they want to join your team, and it's just really fun to be a part of.
Let's talk about that culture building a little bit more specifically. So you've talked about being a much larger team where you can't connect with everybody personally. So how are some of the ways, what are some of the really specific things you've done to help sort of keep generating that culture and engendering it? Yeah. As the team has grown larger.
Well, all along the way, I keep thinking, how did Jesus do it? Because at different stages, and one of the things you find is it's as things grew, he actually went deeper with his core, but he also was very deliberate about the big message he gave to everyone. So there's kind of two directions you go. One is that I know that I've got a core team around me, and I can't neglect them. And some of them I've been serving God with for 20 years, but if I start neglecting those relationships or not watching after that, it then ripples. So he kept going deep with his core, and he kept growing them more and more. So I've got to go deep with the core, but then you have these talking to the 5,000. So there's symbolic things where you do. You want the whole to hear your voice. And so I try to do that double. I have a smaller group that I'm investing deep in, but I want the entire team to hear my shepherding voice, because I'm setting the culture for the whole team. I'm not resolving all those little problems, but I'm talking about what's important to us, where we're going, why we're here, how we care about each other, and they're hearing that voice. And then if they watch it modeled in the smaller group, those two messages carry a lot of weight. Now, sometimes I could model in the smaller group and not speak to the whole. I'd be losing something. I could be speaking to the whole and not modeling it with a few, they would start to wonder, is he really believe what
because
he's
those two things interact so strongly, don't right. they? Yes.
So it's that double. He went deep with a few, broad with the message, and that message was, this is who we are, this is what we're about, this is what we care about.
Do you find yourself having to intentionally let go of or avoid getting drawn into things in the middle ground?
Yeah, oh man, it's this constant fight. It's such a fight. One of the things I talk about is that for leaders, called the magnet of the middle. So there's this middle ground where leaders always have to push up higher, and they have to push down lower. Yeah. And they get caught in this middle ground of just a lot of junk that thing you have to take care for. So it's almost like this, when something is spinning fast, it pulls the string in and you get pulled into the middle. And so you always have to push out both directions. So I have to push out, even to where we're a youth ministry organization, I have to get in contact with young people, have a conversation with them, touch them, see their world, feel that. We're an evangelistic organization. I have to share the gospel myself, push it down. We're a disciple-making organization. I have to be discipling a couple people, and I have to push down to that. I have to get real high and see Europe and keep a big picture on what's going on in 16 countries. And both of those are very hard to do. And there's this middle, all this stuff that just pulls you into that. And I would say that's a constant fight as a leader, to push up and push down, get out of the middle.
I remember years ago, a mentor of mine talking about the need to be the plumber rather than the pipe. He said, a pipe with too much going through it is not a good thing. But if you're the plumber right. helping to do the connections, yeah. then you can kind of stay out of that.
Yeah, we just had an interesting response to the Ukraine crisis, which that's a whole nother story. But I told my wife, I said, I would wake up in the morning and I said, I was just walking around with an oil can and basically putting grease in places that were stuck, exactly what you were saying, the plumber. What's stuck and how can I unstick it? How can I unstick it without becoming engaged? Yeah, the person in the middle that's doing it. But how can I open it up? How can I get this person moved here? How can I solve that problem so that it begins to work? So just walk around all day trying to squirt oil and things, encourage people, loosen that problem and keep the whole thing working.
In your sort of agricultural paradigm that you've been talking about, you've needed to grow some people into more stretching and senior leadership roles. What are some of the observations that you share with us, some of the insights about how you help people to sort of make that step up in the way that you described yourself having to do?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'd maybe back up and add something I haven't added yet, and then I'll go into your question. It's so fascinating to follow Jesus as he builds his team. It's just amazing. Because you see key spots of intensive prayer before he makes a forward move. So an all night in prayer before he appoints the 12. And then even in Matthew 9, he says, the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Pray the Lord of the harvest to send more forth workers in his field. So there is an aspect, even of developing people, where we have to pull back and wait on the Lord and say, you know, God, what's going on with that person? How can I understand that? What's your view of who you made them to be? How? So there's a listening aspect to leadership development that prayer is really important. But then what's interesting is he prays all night and then he appoints them. So then there's this action that comes out of prayer. And sometimes people don't pray, or other times they just pray, just wait for God to do something, and there's not action. So Matthew 10, he goes out and he sends out the 72 and he tells them exactly what to do. And there's this very deliberate, focused leadership that's quite specific. Say this, don't do this. That's quite directive. And so how do we get that mix of both the spiritual listening to on the Lord and that active development of leaders? And so this is back, how do you grow your leaders? I think it involves both of those. It involves a pulling back and a praying about them, a thinking about them, thinking who God created them to be, and then an engagement. And one of the things that I talk to our leaders about, I'm always trying to find their leadership ceiling. So what's the spot? Because leaders peak out. They get to a place and then they get stuck. And if I can help them with that particular piece of their leadership ceiling, their overall capacity will increase. And for some people, their leadership ceiling might be the relationship with their wife. And that really is what's holding them back in their leadership most. Someone else, it might be their inability to delegate. Someone else, it might be, well, they need to get a bigger kind of intellectual understanding of what's going on. So, but I'm always thinking, if I were to push them up to the top of their capacity, what are they running into that's holding them back? And how can I help them raise that leadership ceiling? And then you see when Jesus developed his leaders, we often talk about something called TAR, that he had this leadership development involves three things that you do. If you want it to be sticky, you want it to be TAR, it was teach, act, reflect. Teach, act, reflect. And sometimes he would start with, in the middle, you don't have to do it always exactly in that order, but he would talk about something, and then he'd say, follow me, or I'll make you fishers of men, or he'd speak on something. And then they'd go and do a fishing trip. He'd be in the synagogue, there'd be action, or he'd say, how many loaves of fish do you have? They didn't know. Well, go find out. And then there's this reflection. So what did you learn? Hey, you never learned the idea of the loaves and the fishes. You haven't gotten this yet. Why couldn't you cast out the demons? Because of your little faith. And there's this reflection that's involved. And so this combination of teach, action, act, reflect, and sometimes he would act, reflect, teach. So it's this circle. It's just going on and on and on. And what you'll find is you'll find some leaders, they just do the action. They just go do something. They just do the teaching, or sometimes they don't do the reflection. And it's that combination. So as I'm working on developing leaders, I'm thinking, how can I give them information about this, experiences, and then reflect with them on what they're doing and on their performance to try to see if we can raise that leadership ceiling.
What does good reflection look like in practice? I'm asking that because I feel as though it's often a really neglected sort of aspect of that trio that you're talking about. What does it look like in practice? So if you were trying to help a new leader.
I think sometimes you're asking them to observe because they're not observing. You might say, hey, did you notice that the room kind of got flat right there? Any ideas why that was? Or do you see that this is kind of a repeating area of conflict? Wonder why that is. So you can inquire. Or sometimes you have reflections that they don't know. So I was talking with one of our leaders, and he led a meeting, just did an excellent job. And I said, you know, you're right up there at the top. There's one thing you could do that could really improve your delivery. And he said, what? And I said, every sentence has two or three uhs and ums. And it just is messy. It's not cleaning up your leadership. Wow. Now, are there sometimes where you don't do that? Sometimes that you do? I wonder why that is. What could help you? And so we have this discussion and reflection on an observation that I made back. And in the very next meeting, he was cleaning it up. So some of it has to do with, and this is actually in leadership, you have to, I feel like probably a third to half of my time is actually spent in developing our leaders. So I'm leading an organization, but to lead the organization, really, I have to be always investing in the future of the organization. That's that husbandry work.
And what strikes me is there's a particular skill, and there's many skills that are inherent in what you're saying, but one of the skills there is observation. So your ability and your commitment to observing what is going on in people, in rooms, in group dynamics and so on, then opens up the potential to coach people, to help people grow and develop.
Right, and one of the challenges is that sometimes it means you just sit there for an hour while somebody else does all the work, and you can feel as a senior leader, I'm wasting time right now because I should be working, and all I'm doing is watching someone else
do it. Phone
right, yeah, and that's the temptation. But then you're shortcut. Then you're not caring for your flock. Then you're not investing in your future, and so that what happens is that starts to come back and eat at you. It's amazing if you invest in your leaders and care for them. And caring for them is not just caring for it. You want them to be productive. It's not just you want their life to be comfortable. You want them actually to do something significant for the kingdom. You want to stretch them. It's like a coach wanting the best performance out of his players. If you do that, a lot of your other problems, they take care of. If you build into them. If you don't do that, you'll be buried in all the little problems that they're not taking care of because they're unmotivated, they're untrained, they're not growing. And then you get on the bad side of that cycle. So that's where that organic approach to leadership actually really works.
Yeah, and the cultivating metaphor is entirely, this is all really consistent with that, because a good farmer will be really watching what's happening to the grapes on the vines or the
And then there's a couple other laws of organic. Unless in organic processes you have multiplication, which in inorganic processes don't have multiplication. I can build. There's a lot of chairs in this room. I can have 500 chairs, but every chair I have to build individually. That they don't reproduce themselves. And so in organic systems they do. You have an apple, and then you have a tree, and then you have 10 trees, and then you get into this amazing multiplication. In organic systems. So it feels slower, but it's actually much faster because the living things reproduce. So if you build into a leader well, they reproduce, and then you have a number of other leaders. If you're in the factory system, as an organization grows, it's more and more burden on the leader. So I'll give you one example. One of the things we're going to talk about when I do the seminar, and this is even things like funding or different things like that. We do delegated fundraising in our organization. You could say 350 staff, how do you pay for all that? Well, they pay for that. I actually only raise money for forward motion. So we talk about coal and wood. We do coal, non-repeatable resources for pushing us forward. We maintain with wood. We try to do sustainable resources. So what we do is we train our people to build teams of people of supporters that support them with $50 a month or 20 euros or something like that. Well, that's a lot of work to equip them to do that on the front end, but actually it's a sustainable model that you can grow. It'd be maybe quicker to do the factor approach or the hunter-gatherer where I go out and do it all myself. I don't build that capacity into the people, but then you're ceiling out. And I'd have a staff of 15 or 20 and be really tired of fundraising for all of them, where you equip them to do that, and you have this organic system that's caring for itself.
Dave, I feel like we could talk about this all evening, and it's been a joy to have this conversation. Any final thoughts, anything you wanted to just highlight in thinking about this paradigm that we haven't managed to touch?
Yeah, well, I would just say team building is one of the most important aspects of leadership. The African proverb says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. So it should be a key section of everyone's leadership. And look at Jesus. How much time did he spend building that team of 12 with all of the needs around him and all of the sick people that wanted to be healed and all of the preaching opportunities? He was always building that team. So I'd say that's one of the most important aspects of leadership. And then in that team, building a balanced team. When he called his disciples, he had a zealot and a tax collector. Whoa, a zealot. Their identity is kick out the Romans. A tax collector, someone who worked for the Romans. And so you actually have this diversity and balance built into your team. And so part of it is, how do you keep from a monoculture? How do you build teams that are balanced with gifting and ability and even perspectives? And so someone said the purpose of a team is to maximize everyone's gifts and render their weaknesses irrelevant, which that's is really their weakness is irrelevant because at that place someone else is serving. So I'd say that's the other thing is, as you build teams, think about diversity, even diversity of opinion and diversity of gifting, so that you have this balanced team that can do much more than any person could do alone.
Well, praise God for his work in you and through you and through Josiah Venture. It's been a real privilege to be able to have this conversation.
Thank you so much, Jen. Thank you.